top stories, Iran's president says efforts to neutralize sanctions against his country are not tied to negotiations with the P4 plus one group. Israel extends the imprisonment of a chronically ill Palestinian teenager under its much-criticized administrative detention policy. And North Korea test fires more ballistic missiles hours after it warned of strong reaction in case of new U.S. sanctions. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says his administration is putting efforts to remove anti-Iran sanctions high on the agenda. In a tweet, President Raisi says the efforts to neutralize the sanctions are not tied to the ongoing talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. He says despite the existing sanctions, Iran is selling oil. Raisi says the sales have now increased to the level that no worries are left, and the generated revenues are being returned to the country. Back in May of 2018, Iran was hit by rounds of sanctions that came into effect following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA. Part of the measures hit the Iranian oil sector. Iran says the sanctions are illegal and it has the right to sell oil in international markets. Now, as the eighth round of talks goes on in Vienna to revive the JCPOA, the United States, which is indirectly taking part in the negotiations, says there are only a few weeks left to save the accord. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. is ready to look at other options and steps if negotiations fail. The talks taking place between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA began in April of last year. The U.S. is not a party to the deal because it withdrew in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In response, Tehran rolled back its JCPOA commitments a year later. Tehran says although sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner, Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it will not leave the deal again. Israel extends the imprisonment of a chronically ill Palestinian teenager under its so-called administrative detention policy. The father of Amal Nakhla says his son will remain in detention for four more months. Amal has already been held for over a year, for 1 year, I should say. A 17-year-old was arrested after throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. Amal has recovered from cancer surgery. He is now suffering from myasthenia. That's a rare neuromuscular disease. The teenager is among minors held under Israel's administrative detention policy that allows for suspects to be detained without charge or trial. More than 450 Palestinians are held under that policy. The practice is widely criticized by international rights organizations. We've spoken to Mona Kandil. She's our correspondent in the West Bank, to get more on the case of Palestinian teenager Amal Nakhla and other inmates held under the Israeli administrative detention policy.
The Israeli authorities claim that Amal Nakhla threw stones at the Israeli soldiers and at the nearby illegal settlement of Beit Im. But clearly there are no evidence. They couldn't present a charge with evidence, with eyewitnesses, to say that Amal Nakhla, according to them, is a criminal, throw stones at the full-armed Israeli forces and the fully armed Israeli settlers. Human rights organizations and experts continue to ask, what danger could Amal Nakhla be making for the Israeli authorities? So now Amal Nakhla would remain in jail for 4 months, but who knows, maybe the Israeli authorities, after the end of these 4 months, they can extend his detention as they do with other Palestinian prisoners. We are speaking today about some 500 Palestinians held under the so-called administrative detention amid international calls for Israel to either release them or prosecute them. And this detention pushed the Palestinians to go for hunger strikes,
When some Persian Gulf Arab states announced normalization deals with Israel, it was no surprise to many since they'd already held or had an unofficial relationship behind the scenes. But the formal announcements, like in the case of the UAE, drew the anger of many of their own citizens. They felt their governments had betrayed them. Some of those who felt betrayed were Arab intellectuals, writers, and artists. Some decided to boycott a festival in the UAE as a form of protest.
Arab intellectuals and ordinary people are still angry over UAE's normalization of ties with Israel. A number of intellectuals from Persian Gulf Arab states have announced that they will boycott a literature festival that is set to take place in Abu Dhabi in February. Omani writer Bushra Khalfan and Kuwaiti writers Mona Al-Shamri, Ahmed Al-Zamam and Ali Ashur decided to boycott the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature.
Yeah, I guess this development indeed shows that there is a large number of people who disapprove. And that has been the case all along, because we need to keep in mind that these regimes are not elected by their population, and they don't necessarily make decisions on behalf of the population in these countries.
The intellectuals have cited UAE's normalization of ties with Israel for the decision to boycott the event. The list of invitees included writers, academics, and intellectuals from a number of Arab countries. Other writers from Persian Gulf countries have also been called to withdraw from the event. The festival will take place from February the 3rd to 13th at its new venue for 2022. UAE's image has been tarnished amongst Arab intellectuals and ordinary people for its decision to normalize ties. Palestinians have described the move as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
And of course, the public communication and freedom of speech is very strongly restricted in the UAE, which means that public dissent and in this case, and of course, public expressions against the normalization with the Israeli regime, of course, can lead to consequences for the populations.
The U.S., even after the departure of former President Donald Trump, has been advocating for more countries to normalize ties with Israel. Some of the states that have announced unofficial diplomatic relations with Israel, in addition to the UAE, are Sudan, Bahrain, and Morocco. Normalization drive calls into question these countries' commitment to the cause of Palestine.
The United Arab Emirates is amongst a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States in 2020. The Emiratis opened their embassy in Israel in July 2021. Israel has also opened an embassy in the Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi, and the consulate in the UAE business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals ranging from financial services to tourism. And in December, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the UAE to further deepen the ties between the two regimes. The UAE was not the only country to normalize its ties with Israel. Bahrain, Sudan and Morocco have also established diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already vowed to help Israel normalize relations with additional countries in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Blinken said the Biden administration would continue to build on the successful efforts of the last administration to keep normalization marching forward.
Well, the Israeli colony is in many ways a proxy and a military base for the United States, and it helps secure the U.S. role in Western Asia and beyond. So, of course, the Israeli regime is of essential importance for the United States, and expanding Israel's ties to the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and then potentially other governments and regimes in the region is, of course, of central interest because Israel is central for the military-industrial complex.
Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stance adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Now, that, as a result, of course, the Palestinians struggle has not been of any importance, or has even rather become an obstacle for many of these regimes. But at the same time, of course, it does not reflect necessarily the popular mood in these places, where many people are, of course, pro-Palestinian and do support the liberation of Palestine.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel.
South Korea and Japan say the North has conducted a new weapons test, firing projectiles eastward. The two countries say North Korea used two short-range ballistic missiles in the latest test. Pyongyang has already carried out two tests of what it called hypersonic missiles in the past week. Following that, the U.S. imposed sanctions on five people linked to North Korea's ballistic weapons program. The sanctions are the first by U.S. President Joe Biden's administration. North Korea says the measure is a provocation and the U.S. is intentionally escalating the situation. Pyongyang says its recent missile tests are an exercise of its right to self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. The British Queen's second son, Prince Andrew, is stripped of his royal and military titles as he faces a U.S. civil case for sexual assault. According to British media, Prince Andrew will no longer be entitled to enjoy his Royal Highness title. The Buckingham Palace has also said the prince was given up his honorary military titles and charitable roles. That comes after more than 150 British veterans wrote to Queen Elizabeth, calling on her to strip Andrew of his ranks and titles in the armed forces. The Duke of York is facing public outrage over his sexual misconduct. He denies any wrongdoing, but on Wednesday, a U.S. federal judge rejected an appeal over allegations that Andrew sexually assaulted a woman when she was 17. Virginia Giuffre accuses Andrew of assaulting her in 2001. Another blow to Boris Johnson's shaky premiership. Fresh reports say staff at the British Prime Minister's office partied on the eve of the socially distanced funeral of the Queen's husband, Prince Philip. The UK-based Daily Telegraph says number 10 staff gathered on April the 16th of last year for two separate leaving events. One was for James Slack, that's Prime Minister's departing director of communications. Another one for a personal photographer of Johnson. The events took place the day before Prince Philip was laid to rest. At that time, social gatherings were banned across the UK as part of COVID restrictions. Johnson himself was absent at those parties, but he is already facing calls to resign over several more parties held at Downing Street during lockdowns. Critics, including those from Labour, say Johnson is unfit to head the government and cannot be trusted. 5 months into an energy crisis in the UK, a controversial blog post by one of the country's major energy suppliers has prompted a wave of outrage. It comes as average households face a sharp rise in their energy bills starting in spring, coupled with rising taxes and stalling wages. Our correspondent in London, Said Pureza, has more.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer, do star jumps, or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mould, damp and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse. So
it's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saeed Purizza, London.
And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
As Iran leaves behind one death anniversary right after New Year, it commemorates two other assassinations too. Those are of the nuclear scientists Ali Mohammadi and Ahmadi Roshan. They were murdered respectively on January the 12th, 2010, and January the 11th, 2012. He was a professor setting out for work at Tehran University. But what Masood Ali Mohammadi didn't know was that that morning there was a remote-controlled bomb attached to his car. The blast killed him and injured two other people. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists have met fates similar to his since 2007, with Israel being the prime suspect. For a look at these incidents and the why and how of them in a context of Israeli state terrorism, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. As for Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, he was assassinated 2 years later. How it happened was a magnetized explosive was attached to the side of his car on his way to work by a team of motorcycle riding assailants. The blast also hit his driver Reza Ghashghari, who later died from the injuries. Western intelligence sources said Ahmadi Roshan was a victim of Israel's intelligence agency Mossad. Mossad secretly uses extraterritorial locations and employs locals to carry out its killings abroad. In connection with the Ahmadi Roshan assassination, it was Arash Kerhat Kish who came under interrogation to admit, "In this location, meaning Ketabi Square, Golnabi Street, we reached the car and attached the bomb to the car and the bomb exploded near the white fence," as reported by Mehr News Agency. Let's hear it in an expert's words, why there's no doubt of Israeli culpability. Mr. Parkayin was ambassador and his views draw on years of diplomatic experience. He now receives us at his beautiful home adorned with memorabilia from his postings.
The Chronicle is one of the newspapers close to Israel. The paper published an article written by Jake Simmons that exposed Israel's role in the assassination of Mr. Ali Mohammadi in 2009, as well as sabotage attempts in Natanz and Karaj nuclear facilities. The point I didn't mention was that Israel, in addition to assassinating Iran's nuclear scientists, is trying to sabotage Iran's nuclear facilities in Natanz and Karaj. Unfortunately, some of the information leaked by IAEA inspectors to Israel has helped them conduct operations, all in violation of international law, at various times against Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
According to Time of January the 13th, 2012, it was told by Western intelligence sources that like three Iranian scientists already ambushed on their way to work, Ahmadi Roshan was a victim of Israel's Mossad. On June the 17th, 2012, the then-Iranian intelligence minister, Haidar Moslehi, announced the arrests of a team of 20 people, blaming the attack on the CIA, Mossad and MI6, the British intelligence agency. Mr. Barati is a political analyst with attention to detail in relating and analyzing incidents. So we made a trip deeper into Tehran for an interview with him.
Given the method and the violent nature of the operation, which is in violation of international law, the likes of which took place in other countries, including Iraq, it can be concluded that Israel was behind the operations. This has been confirmed by informal sources, media and others. For example, in Israel's latest terrorist move, the case of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination, media close to Israel's intelligence agencies published and leaked the details of the operation.
A Mossad agent, Majid Jamali Fashi, was sentenced to death for his role in the killing of Ali Mohammadi. Three other nuclear scientists heard magnetic bombs snap onto their car doors during their commute to work, a method Fashi claimed he had also been taught by the Israelis. Besides Ahmadi Roshan and Shahriari, the victims include Feridun Abbasi, a university professor who survived and was promoted to head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. It was the 29th of November when both men, Abbasi and Shahriari's cars, were approached by men on motorbikes who stuck magnet bombs to the side of cars. Majid Shahriari was killed on the spot and his wife was wounded, while Feridun Abbasi Davani and his wife were both wounded. The explosions happened in front of Shahid Behesht University. Israel has committed an ongoing series of assassinations and sabotage in Iran, presumably with the backing of America. Our guests of the day will help verify. Western intelligence sources, as a matter of fact, said in 2012, in addition to the assassination campaign, Israel was responsible for the massive explosion at a missile base outside of Tehran in November. Enlisting some American-Israeli hostilities, Mr. Barati remembers the scientists lost to this country. As for America, with Trump's departure from the JCPOA, not only was the spirit of the JCPOA not preserved, but actions were taken completely contrary to the original text of that deal.
In 2009,
Rasul Ali Mohammadi was assassinated. That was an extraordinary year for the Islamic Republic, as we were dealing with the aftermath of Iran's presidential elections, and there was a particular confusion inside the country that was perhaps unprecedented at the time. Back then, Israel took advantage of the turmoil and assassinated an effective person in Iran's nuclear program. About a year later, we lost Dr. Shariari in a similar assassination. Almost everyone is certain that Israel perpetrated the assassination. If you follow the developments of Iran's nuclear program, there was a period of time when Iran was running out of fuel for the Tehran research reactor, where medicine used to treat cancer produced. It was running out of fuel with a 20% purity level. Iran announced to the negotiating parties that it requires fuel. They, in turn, started to play games as they thought they could take many concessions from Iran. It was the efforts of such men that made Iran self-sufficient in this field.
It was between the two sets of assassinations of 2010 and 2012 that Dariush Rezai Nejad was shot five times and killed near his house on July the 23rd, 2011, by a team of motorcycle-riding gunmen. It was after he had picked up his daughter from kindergarten, and the attack left both his daughter and wife injured. Germany's Der Spiegel said in August of the same year, 2011, that Mossad was behind the operation. As for the most recent attack, it was on an ace nuclear scientist on the 27th of November 2020. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's car was targeted by an explosion and machine gun fire in Damavand's Absad. That's 40 kilometers to the east of Tehran. Mossad had apparently gained access to Fakhrizadeh's name via a UN list. Ali Shamkhani, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, SNSC, said that electronic equipment was used in the highly complicated assassination of Fakhrizadeh, underlining the role of Israel and the anti-Iranian MEK or MKO, Mojahedine Khalq organization. All indications point to Israel as the main culprit. There's concrete circumstantial evidence galore, such as similarities between operations, as well as intelligence reports from neighbors and Western states, and accusations by Western allies of Israel, and the occasional admission by Israeli authorities. And let's not forget Israeli media reports.
رسانه‌های رژیم صهیونیستی معمولاً بعد از هر تروری رسماً اعلام کردند.
Israeli media have announced Tel Aviv's involvement after every assassination. Mossad officials announced they assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. American and European officials and media have repeatedly said there are traces of US and Britain's involvement in the assassinations and that their intelligence services aid the assassination of the nuclear scientists, which is a clear example of state terrorism.
Would Israel dare carry on as it does had it not been for American support, or at least a go-ahead?
I believe Israel can be seen as opposing US policies. The two complement each other on deeper and hidden levels. There are strategic issues that can explain the matter. One is a good cop, bad cop, and another is a strategic pattern. On the surface, the two have different opinions on the matter, and you'd want to cooperate with the good cop to avoid dealing with the bad cop. But the reality is that they both see the same thing. As you can see, the talks we've had with the P5+1 over the past 8 years, including with the US itself, didn't prevent Israel's assassinations and sabotage attempts. I argue that the talks actually made the matter worse and enabled Israel to perpetrate them more easily. The reason is that we provided the International Atomic Energy Agency unprecedented access to inspect our nuclear facilities under the 2015 deal. We went beyond the additional protocol. There are different levels of cooperation with the agency. One at the level of NPT and safeguards, one at the level of the additional protocol, and the other was our permission to inspect and install monitoring cameras and other supervision techniques to the IAEA. Almost everybody knows that whatever the IAEA finds is almost certainly provided to Western intelligence services, including that of Israel.
Talking of Israeli interest within a context of Western support or contradiction, that Zionist entity's sabotage of Iran's nuclear program is as old as the program itself, at least post-revolution. And it does not seem to care if the program is for peaceful purposes.
Well, Israel has been opposing JCPOA talks. Tel Aviv managed to convince the UN Security Council, with the help of the US, to issue 4 resolutions against Iran and impose sanctions on Tehran. Israel managed to persuade Europe to impose sanctions on Iran's banking sector and oil sales. But after the talks started and Iran proposed its strong logic in the negotiations, all 4 resolutions were repealed and the world realized Tehran is seeking peace.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
A 20% uranium enrichment capacity was a target for producing medical isotopes and the like. But with Western parties' failure to commit to the JCPOA or nuclear deal, Iran has been enriching uranium up to 60%. It is now looking to results with the sanction-lifting Vienna talks to reverse its nuclear activity yet again. But Israel is uneasy with the West coming to terms with Iran all the same. Interestingly, a revival of the JCPOA and therefore U.S. sanctions being lifted off Iran may yield minimal results for this country. Yes, it will be able to extract and export oil to its standard levels at global prices. But after America's deal-breaking in 2018, major Western companies will no longer dare enter into business with us. Not until they can be sure of U.S. commitment to the deal. And the downside is, former U.S. President Donald Trump, who binned the deal in 2018, could make a comeback in 2024. However, Iran can get by, even if only oil and banking sanctions are lifted.
روی کرده خونسازی به این معنی هست که اگر آمریکایی‌ها
Taking the neutralization approach means that if the Americans don't remove the sanctions, we can resort to other means to strengthen our economy and find trusted partners to sell our oil, take in the revenue and export our non-oil products and transfer money. We've gathered enough experience of how to do that under sanctions. This means we can move towards a situation where the sanctions have the least harmful effect on Iran.
Plenty more on the matter coming up, but first a quick media review with Mohammed.
Welcome to another news section. I'm Mohammed Gord, and in this episode, we are discussing Iran's nuclear program and Israel's acts of sabotage and terror against it. First, we have a report by the New York Times titled Iran's Nuclear Program Ignites New Tensions Between the U.S. and Israel. According to the report, long-running differences over how to deal with Iran's nuclear program have erupted into new tensions between the Biden administration and Israel, with 2 senior Israeli officials leaving Washington this week concerned that the Americans' commitment to restoring the 2015 nuclear deal will lead to a flawed agreement allowing Tehran to speed ahead with its nuclear enrichment program. The report goes on by saying the strains were evident all week as the Biden administration sought to bring the alliance with Israel into a united front about how to deal with Iran over the next year. But at the heart of the tensions between Israel and the United States is the fundamental disagreement over how to approach the Iranian nuclear program. It is not a new argument. The two allies fought bitterly over the 2015 agreement which Israel opposed and President Barack Obama signed. More recently, they've disagreed about the wisdom of the Israeli sabotage of Iranian facilities, which Mr. Bennett's government believes has set back the program, and which some in the United States argue only encourages the Iranian to build back the nuclear enrichment facilities with more efficient and up-to-date equipment. Meanwhile, a report published in the Financial Tribune says sustainable sanctions relief is the only way to address the nuclear standoff. The report cites a Middle East specialist saying the only way to address Iran's nuclear issue is for the United States to lift its economic sanctions and ensure sustainability of the 2015 nuclear deal from which it once withdrew unilaterally. If the US does, Iran for its part will fully implement its commitments under the JCPOA permanently. That's what Hossein Mousavian said in an article published by the Middle East Eye. Mousavian also offered two other scenarios, the first being what many Israeli officials are advocating, a US military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities in case of a failure to restore the JCPOA. I believe that this is a bluff to put more pressure on Iran. The US is in no mood to launch a new war in the Middle East, he said. The second scenario would be a continuation of Trump's failed strategy of maximum pressure, namely full-blown economic, political, and cyber wars with sabotage including continuing Israeli covert attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinations of its nuclear scientists. Thanks for joining me in this episode's news section. And now, back to Leila.
Now, regarding the extent to which Israel might be able to influence the Vienna talks, which are moving in the direction of an understanding between Iran and Western parties to the deal, given Israel's weakened position with the Islamic Resistance Axis having surrounded it, its apartheid government, and its being a UN member without having signed up with the NPT, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, its allies appear less zealous in supporting it.
The French government and Mr. Macron said Israel is taking a path that leads to apartheid. The racism and apartheid in Israel, which is internationally reprehensible, together with its inability to manage itself and the COVID-19 pandemic, which has turned into a real problem for Tel Aviv, is prompting mass migrations from Israel.
Also, even if it's just a game of good cop, bad cop between America and Israel in dealing with Iran, America has come to realize that warlike hostility towards Iran is only pushing this country closer to independence with a nuclear program that has been indigenized and is working faster and more efficiently than before. The one thing that had limited the program was the nuclear deal that the U.S. ditched. We now have Mr. Hanizadeh, an analyst worth hearing, even if only online.
The Israeli foreign minister's visit to European countries to stop the progress made in Vienna talks have failed. The differences between U.S. President Joe Biden's team and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has prevented Tel Aviv from sabotaging the talks during the 7th and 8th round of negotiations. That's why it appears that Israel is no longer likely to be able to affect the process of talks in Vienna, since it has exhausted all its political and economic capabilities. Despite all that, good progress is made in the talks, and the Israeli regime will suffer defeat soon.
The assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientists aside, in the 20 months running up to November 2021, there had been 4 explosions at Iranian nuclear facilities attributed to Israel. Explosions that took uranium enrichment plants offline and destroyed dozens of centrifuges. Noting this and the fact that Iran had managed to resume enrichment within months, often installing newer machines that can enrich uranium far faster, U.S. officials reportedly gave a friendly warning to the Israelis that while preemptive attacks and assassinations may be tactically satisfying, they are ultimately counterproductive.
Over the past 10 years, Israel attempted to conduct sabotage operations in Natanz and Karaj nuclear facilities 9 times, 3 of which were successful, and 6 others were stopped. The regime is trying to either assassinate Iranian scientists or attack Iranian nuclear facilities directly. Relevant institutions are vigilant and have been able to neutralize the regime's attempts to carry out sabotage operations in Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
In improving its modern warfare defenses, Iran made sure to cover the cyber field. This would make it much harder to pull off cyber attacks such as Stuxnet. That was the US-Israeli stunt that crippled centrifuges at the Natanz nuclear enrichment site for more than a year. Stuxnet, being a malicious computer worm first uncovered in 2010, which targets supervisory control and data acquisition systems. With all the economic pain inflicted on Iran because of U.S. sanctions, there's no telling the United States has any more leverage over this country than it did in the run-up to the 2015 nuclear deal. And that's not just because of Iranian policy, but the U.S.'s own policy of taking an aggressively hostile stance towards the European Union over Iran. Because this has made the EU rethink its reliance on the U.S. Just as a reminder, the 2015 nuclear deal, which became operational in 2016, was to award Iran relief from nuclear-related economic sanctions imposed on it by the UN in return for Iran rolling back its nuclear program, which Iran did do. Now, Israel has pressed upon its allies that Iran's program is malicious, partly as a smokescreen for its own nuclear program and its scores of nuclear warheads, the number of which it keeps secret.
Israel has 11 active nuclear plants on an area smaller than 22,000 square kilometers, the biggest of which is Dimona, located in the southern Negev Desert, which is producing plutonium at a 98% purity level. Dimona is one of the most polluting nuclear plants in the world, dumping some 30 tons of nuclear waste into the Mediterranean Sea. The Eastern Mediterranean is witnessing more environmental pollution year by year. This is one of the environmental dangers threatening the region.
Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has campaigned against Iran for almost 30 years, accusing it of secretly developing nuclear weapons for use against Israel. He advocated for no less than crippling sanctions and even war against this country. Now, Israel is the entity it is. Its invasive founding has, yes, caused it to base its survival on terrorism. What's astounding is how international conventions and organizations haven't taken it upon themselves to respond appropriately. Israel's acts of hostility in this country are as old as Iran's nuclear program itself. Why is it that the global community, even international organizations, have sat quiet?
The most important reason is that there are international organizations like the IAEA, which is an agency that has to strive to prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons and at the same time protect the country's rights to have peaceful nuclear programs and their scientists and facilities. But they don't provide that support. The year after the assassination of Mr. Fakhrizadeh, IAEA Secretary General Mr. Grassi hasn't taken action or condemned the move. These institutions are legally under the control of dominant powers, which in this case is the United States.
That'll be it for today. Long live the memory of those who served. Thanks for staying with us to review legacies. Do join us again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue,
a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. As you well know, dear listeners, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. We find in the history books that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was intentionally arrested and he was thrown into dark prisons where he remained for many years. We also find in the history books that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was put under some of the most severest of tortures, and they made him suffer from pain and misfortunes. But the beauty and the behaviors and the akhlaq, the morals and ethics, and this perseverance and patience and steadfastness of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam resulted in that despite these trials and tribulations and tortures and imprisonment and pains and misfortunes and sufferings, Imam al-Kadhim never grumbled, nor did he complain, nor did he whine, nor did he show any impatience towards all that befell upon him. And rather, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam showed gratitude to Allah. He praised and worshipped Allah more than even the people who weren't facing all of these different calamities and tragedies. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam thanked and praised Allah for giving him the time and the dedication to serve and obey Allah. These are the dialogues of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام من طلب هذا الرزق من حله ليعود به على نفسه وعياله كان كالمجاهد في سبيل الله عز وجل فإن غلب عليه فليستدن على الله وعلى رسوله صلى الله عليه وآله ما يقوت به عياله.
إمام موسى الكاظم عليه السلام stated, "One who seeks to gain sustenance for himself and his family in a lawful manner is as the one who fights in the way of Allah. But if he is unable to do so, he may incur debt, trusting in Allah and his Prophet in order to ensure provisions for his family."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the different conversations and the beautiful dialogues of the divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, that he urged and recommended and almost ordered his companions to accompany religious scholars, ulama, and to sit with them. Now, when Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam talks about sitting with the religious scholars, and of course we're talking about the good, righteous, noble, honorable religious scholars, Imam al-Kadhim is not simply saying to sit with them. Of course, what means is to talk with them. And in other places, if we make it even a little more specific and precise, is to actually listen to them. On a quick tangent, some of our brothers and sisters have a tendency to just go and merely argue for argument's sake, or to debate just for the sake of debating. This is incorrect, this is improper, and it is considered rude and arrogant. When one is faced with a wise and knowledgeable scholar, religious scholar, an alim, a knowledgeable scholar of the deen of Islam, one should listen more than one should speak. And so here Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, in order for one to be able to benefit from the science and the teachings and the education and the morals of these religious scholars, and in order to follow the behavior of these religious scholars, which of course these religious scholars, noble, righteous, honest, truthful religious scholars, are actually the ones who are following the sciences and the morals and the behaviors of the Ahlul Bayt, the divinely appointed imams and the Holy Prophet and the Quran. And so this is why we follow the religious scholar, because the religious scholar is more accurately and more precisely following the Ahlul Bayt, the Quran, and the Word of Allah. And so here Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says to his companion in this conversation that talking with a religious scholar on dung hills is better than talking with an ignorant person on cushions. And so here the reference to dunghills has come because that's not exactly one of the nicer things for an individual to sit on, a heap of dung. But Imam al-Kadhim is saying that to sit on a heap of dung and speak with a religious scholar, a noble, righteous religious scholar who will surely guide you towards the path of Allah, is better than talking with a person who is ignorant, even if it is on the softest and most comfortable of cushions. So again, the emphasis and the need to talk with the noble and righteous religious scholars, and on the other hand, the commandment and the order to refrain from talking to ignorant people. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam is saying there are two hujjat. One is that aql, which is daruni, which is in us, that we have. And then there is aql, which is outside, which is the hujjat of God, which is the proof of God. Because there is a possibility of the internal aql being influenced from outside. The internal aql making an error. If that internal aql makes an error, then you have the imam outside. Because that is why qiyas in our school of thought is not considered as a valid methodology in jurisprudence. So therefore, qiyas is your opinion, your intellectual calculation, but there is hujjat which is outside. That, yes, aql is one of the hujjat. From those four, you have the kitab, you have the sunnah, you know, you have the taqreer masum, qawl masum, you have the Quran, right? And then aql as well, and consensus, which is the ijma. So aql is one of them that is there. But if this aql goes against the hujjat, it is not accepted. ¶¶
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/EN. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the